Every hour of your life has 60 minutes. Every minute has 60 seconds. Every circle you draw has 360 degrees. You didn't choose those numbers. Someone chose them for you. Roughly 5,000 years ago, they had no forests, almost no stone, no iron, no copper in the ground beneath their feet. They lived on a flat, sun-scorched floodplain between two unpredictable rivers, surrounded by marsh and desert. By every measure of geography, these people should have struggled for survival until their last generation and lost. Instead, they invented civilization itself. The word first will come up 45 times today because it was the Sumerians who built the first cities. It was they who invented writing and schools, established the first laws, and composed the first epic poem in history. The first wheel and the first empire, all of it. The Sumerians. They even invented beer and dedicated a goddess to it. They called themselves the Black-Headed People. How did they conquer nature? How did they invent medicine before Hippocrates? What did archaeologists find in Sumerian burial sites? This is the extraordinary story of how a culture born in clay and reeds created the blueprint for the entire modern world, and then vanished so completely that for 4,000 years, no one even knew they had existed.
Welcome to Meditative History. I use modern AI technologies and scientific sources to recreate, as accurately as possible, the eras we could once only imagine. I hope you enjoy it.
To understand the Sumerians, you must first understand the land that made them. Southern Mesopotamia, the territory between the Tigris and the Euphrates, is not a place that invites settlement. Summer temperatures are extreme. Rainfall is scarce and unpredictable. When it does rain, it crashes down in a wall of water, floods the plain, and vanishes, leaving cracked, dry earth behind. The two rivers, for all their life-giving power, are dangerously volatile. Unlike the Nile, whose floods arrive on schedule, the Tigris and Euphrates surge without warning. They change course. They swallow fields. They erase entire villages in a single season. The land swings between drought and catastrophic flood, a cycle so brutal that the Sumerians wove it into their deepest mythology. In their telling, the gods once sent a great flood to destroy all of humanity. Only one man survived Utnapishtim by building a boat and loading it with the seed of every living thing. Thousands of years later, that story would resurface in the Book of Genesis as the tale of Noah. But beneath this hostility lay extraordinary potential. Over millennia, the rivers had deposited deep layers of rich, fertile silt. The soil of southern Mesopotamia was among the most productive on Earth, if and only if water could be controlled. And this single condition, the need to master water, would alter the trajectory of all human civilization. Before the Sumerians arrived, the region was already inhabited. An earlier people, known to archaeologists as the Ubaid culture, had built the first irrigation ditches, mud brick temples, and farming settlements across the plain. They left behind painted pottery, simple shrines, and a network of small villages. But they did not build cities. They did not write. They did not organize themselves into anything remotely resembling a state. Then, sometime near the end of the 4th millennium BC, a new group appeared. We do not know where they came from. Their language, Sumerian, is unlike any other language on Earth. It has no known relatives. Linguists call it a language isolate, a tongue that stands alone. Clues buried in their vocabulary hint at outside origins. The names of their own rivers, Tigris and Euphrates, are not Sumerian words. Neither are the names of their greatest cities, Ur, Nippur, Lagash. Even the words for basic farming activities, plough, farmer, to sow, were borrowed from another language. someone was here before them. The Sumerians adopted the land, its tools, and its place names, and then transformed everything. According to their own myths, they came from a paradise island called Dilmun, identified by some scholars as modern-day Bahrain. Whether this was literal history or a founding myth, we may never know. What we do know is that once they arrived, southern Mesopotamia was never the same. The Sumerians' first and most consequential innovation was not a tool or a technology. It was a decision to reorganize the landscape on a scale no human society had ever attempted. To survive in southern Mesopotamia, you could not simply plant seeds and wait for rain. You had to cut canals across miles of terrain. You had to build embankments to contain the spring floods. You had to dredge silt from waterways season after season. And you had to do all of this not as a family, not as a village, but as a coordinated network of thousands. The irrigation systems the Sumerians constructed were colossal. A single city-state managed an agricultural zone of roughly 300 square kilometers, crisscrossed by canals, dotted with reservoirs, and covered in carefully watered fields. And those systems required constant, backbreaking maintenance. Miss one season of dredging, and the canals would silt up. Miss one season of repairs, and the embankments would collapse. The rivers did not forgive negligence. This is the hidden engine behind the birth of cities. Not ambition, not invention, necessity. When survival depends on a system this large and this fragile, someone has to organize it. Someone has to assign labor. Someone has to measure water, schedule maintenance, resolve disputes between upstream and downstream villages. From this necessity, a new class of authority emerged. At the center of every Sumerian city stood a massive structure, the ziggurat, a stepped temple tower rising above the flat plain like a man-made mountain. The ziggurat was not merely a place of worship. It was the administrative heart of the city. It functioned simultaneously as a temple, a granary, a tax collection office, a courthouse, and in some cases, a textile factory. The priests who managed the ziggurat controlled the land, the water, the surplus grain, and the labor schedules. They set prices, they collected taxes, they distributed rations. In the eyes of the Sumerians, all land belonged to the gods. The priests merely administered it on their behalf. By around 3800 BC, the village was no longer the dominant form of human settlement in southern Mesopotamia. The city had arrived. The greatest of these was Uruk. At its height, between 40,000 and 80,000 people lived within roughly 10 kilometers of walls. For creatures that had lived in groups of 20 or 30 for hundreds of thousands of years, this density was unprecedented. In a village, life was governed by familiarity. You knew every face, every family, every dispute. In Uruk, that system collapsed. Each day, a person moved among thousands of strangers. Social order could no longer rest on personal relationships. It required institutions, and institutions require records. In a village, you can remember who owes what to whom. In a city of 50,000, you cannot. The birth of writing was not inspired by poetry or prayer. It was inspired by accounting. The earliest known written records, clay tablets from the city of Uruk, dating to around 3300 BC, contain no stories, no myths, no songs. They are inventories, tax records, wage ledgers, lists of sheep, barley, and units of labor. Writing began as bureaucracy. Before these tablets, the Sumerians used a simpler system, small clay tokens, a cone for one unit of grain, a ball for 10, a large cone for 60. Each token represented a quantity. Hundreds of these tokens have been found across the ancient Near East. But as Uruk's economy grew more complex, storing thousands of physical tokens became unwieldy. temple officials made a decisive leap. Instead of keeping the tokens themselves, they began pressing them into soft clay to record the information. The physical object was replaced by its image. Representation was born. From there, evolution accelerated. The pressed token marks became simplified drawings, pictograms. A picture of a head meant head. A picture of a bowl meant food. A picture of a foot meant to walk. At first, the system was vast and clumsy. Over 2,000 separate signs, each representing a concrete object. But over centuries, the Sumerians discovered something that would transform not just their own civilization, but all of human communication. Symbols could represent sounds. The Sumerian word for arrow was tai. It had a specific written sign. But once the system shifted toward phonetics, that same sign could be used wherever the sound tai appeared, regardless of meaning. Suddenly, it was possible to write full sentences. Grammar, abstraction, nuance. The complexity of spoken language could now be captured in clay. Sumerian scribes used a reed stylus, pressing it at an angle into soft clay to create wedge-shaped marks. We call this script cuneiform, from the Latin cuneus, meaning wedge. It became the dominant writing system of the ancient Near East for over 3,000 years. Adopted by the Akkadians, Babylonians, Assyrians, Hittites, and dozens of other cultures. Some of the latest known cuneiform texts date to the 1st century AD. This means cuneiform was in use for over 3,000 consecutive years, twice as long as the entire span from the fall of Rome to the present day. And clay, it turns out, was an ideal medium, unlike papyrus, which decays. Unlike parchment, which burns, clay, when fired, even accidentally, in the blazes that destroyed the very cities where it was stored, becomes nearly indestructible. More than 1 million cuneiform tablets have been recovered. Archaeologists are still finding them. They tell us more about daily life in the 3rd millennium BC than we know about most of medieval Europe. With the advent of writing, debts, taxes and obligations ceased to be oral agreements. They became fixed. They could not be forgotten, denied, or retold differently. For the first time, a system could remember more than any person and hold everyone accountable by record, not by memory. The Sumerians did not merely invent writing. They produced an astonishing volume of innovations, many of which are so deeply embedded in our daily lives that we have forgotten where they came from. Their numbering system was based on 60. Why 60? Because of how they counted. Instead of using all 10 fingers, the Sumerians counted the 12 segments, the phalanges, on one hand, while using the 5 fingers of the other to track groups of 12. 5 times 12 equals 60. From this simple gesture, counting on their fingers, they built a mathematical system that still governs your day. 24 hours twice 12. 60 minutes in an hour. 60 seconds in a minute. 360 degrees in a circle. Every time you glance at a clock, check a compass, or measure an angle, all of it traces back to a Sumerian scribe pressing marks into clay. Their mathematics extended far beyond counting. They could solve quadratic equations. They calculated the area of triangles and the volume of cubes. They understood the relationship between the sides of a right triangle, a principle we now call the Pythagorean theorem, more than 1,000 years before Pythagoras was born. They invented the plow, which revolutionized farming by allowing fewer people to produce more food, freeing labor for craftsmanship, trade, and administration. They invented the wheel, first as rollers for heavy objects, then as mounted wheels with axles, then as chariots. Though their chariots were pulled by donkeys rather than horses, the principle was established. Rotary motion could multiply human power. They were the first to build with arches and columns. They invented the sailboat, turning rivers from obstacles into highways. They created the first known legal codes, centuries older than the famous Code of Hammurabi, covering property, trade, marriage, inheritance, and criminal offences. And then there was beer. The Sumerians developed the first known brewing process, fermenting barley into a thick, sweet, unfiltered drink consumed through long reed straws from large communal jars. Beer was not a luxury, it was a dietary staple, and likely safer than city water, since the brewing process involved boiling. They even had a goddess dedicated to it, Ninkasi, whose name translates as the lady who fills the mouth. The hymn to Ninkasi, written around 1800 BC, is essentially the oldest known beer recipe, praising the processes of malting, mashing, and fermentation in poetic verse. They invented soap, mixing animal fat with lye. They created the first schools, where students, mostly boys from elite families, studied reading, writing, mathematics, astronomy, law, and literature. Education is not a modern invention. It is a Sumerian one. And when the people who invented writing encountered disease, they did what they knew best, recorded the symptoms on clay, and began looking for patterns. When a Sumerian fell ill, two people came to see them. The first was called the Asu, a practicing physician. He examined the body, checked the pulse, measured temperature, studied the color of the skin and urine. He prescribed herbal salves, compresses of oil and thyme, tinctures dissolved in beer and honey. The oldest medical tablet in the world, a clay slab from Nippur, dating to roughly 2200 BC, contains 15 specific prescriptions. Pulverize branches of the thorn plant, pour diluted beer over it, rub with vegetable oil, and fasten the paste over the sick spot as a poultice. No magic. Pure pharmaceutics, 2,000 years before Hippocrates. The second was called the Ashipu, an exorcist, because for the Sumerians, illness had a dual nature. Yes, it had physical symptoms, fever, pain, swelling. But behind every symptom lay a cause, and the cause was the intervention of supernatural forces. A demon had entered the body, or an angry god had sent punishment for a sin. The task of the Ashipu was to determine which demon or god was responsible and banish it through incantations, amulets, and rituals. What is remarkable is that both systems operated in parallel, and neither was considered inferior to the other. The Asu treated the body, the Ashipu treated the cause. The patient received both an herbal salve and a prayer, simultaneously. This was not a contradiction. For the Sumerian mind, the physical world and the spiritual world were a single fabric. To treat the body without addressing the spirit would have been as strange as treating a fever while ignoring the wound that caused it. Sumerian medical records were so detailed that from the surviving tablets, scholars can identify descriptions of nearly every major disease known to modern medicine. Their herbal catalogue, the Uruana, listed roughly 340 different medicinal plants. All of it was recorded on clay and organized by the principle of head to toe, from diseases of the skull through the torso down to the feet. The first medical reference book in history was organized in exactly the same way as a modern anatomy textbook. Sumerian medicine was directed at one thing, keeping a person in the world of the living. But their burial rituals suggest that the boundary between life and death was, for them, permeable. A king did not die, he crossed over, and his court crossed over with him. In the 1920s, the world saw exactly what that looked like. In the 1920s, British archaeologist Leonard Woolley was excavating the ancient city of Ur in southern Iraq when he uncovered something that stunned the world. Beneath the surface lay a royal cemetery containing roughly 1,800 graves. Most were simple. A body wrapped in a reed mat, a few possessions beside it, but 16 of these burials were different. They were enormous underground complexes, stone chambers with vaulted ceilings, approached by ramps cut deep into the earth. Inside, the dead were surrounded by treasures of breathtaking craftsmanship, golden helmets, necklaces of lapis lazuli and carnelian, silver lyres, jeweled daggers, delicate floral crowns made entirely of gold leaf, and a mysterious object called the Standard of Ur, an inlaid box depicting scenes of war and feasting in vivid mosaic. But the treasures were not the most disturbing discovery. It was the bodies. In the pits surrounding the royal chambers, Wooly found rows of additional dead, soldiers in copper helmets holding spears near the entrance, women in elaborate golden headdresses arranged in neat lines, musicians still lying beside their instruments, ox-drawn carts with grooms positioned at the heads of the animals. In the largest of these, which Wooly called the Great Death Pit, 74 bodies were found, 6 men and 68 women, all arranged in careful order, all dressed in ceremonial finery. The bodies showed no signs of struggle. The headdresses were undisturbed. It appeared they had walked into the pit, sat down and died. Wooly believed they had taken poison voluntarily, choosing to accompany their king or queen into the afterlife. But recent CT scans of 2 skulls revealed something darker: pre-mortem fractures caused by a blunt instrument. For some attendants, it seems, the poison was not enough. Those who did not die may have been struck on the head to ensure that no one was buried alive. Among the dead, one woman stood apart. Her name was Puabi. A cylinder seal identified her as a queen. Her crown, layered tiers of delicate golden flowers, ribbons of gold and beads of lapis lazuli, remains one of the most stunning objects of the ancient world. And in the pit beneath her chamber, her entire court lay silent, dressed for eternity. We've told you how the Sumerians invented schools, laws, medicine. All of it sounds familiar, almost comfortable, like the prehistory of our own world. The death pits of Ur are a reminder of something else. The civilization we inherit was neither humane nor just. It was effective. And the very same institutions that fed people and educated their children could demand that they walk into a pit and lie down beside their queen. For centuries, the Sumerian city-states existed in a state of near-permanent rivalry. Each city had its own walls, its own patron god, its own army, its own dynasty. Alliances formed and collapsed, borders shifted, kings rose and fell. No single ruler held power long enough to unify the region. Then came Sargon. His origin story reads like a myth, and perhaps partly is. Born to a priestess who could not keep him, he was placed in a reed basket sealed with pitch and set adrift on the Euphrates. A gardener found the infant on the bank and raised him. As a young man, Sargon entered the court of Kish as a cupbearer. What happened next is unknown. The clay tablet that told the story is broken. But when the record resumes, Sargon is king. He did not merely conquer, he transformed the very nature of power. Before Sargon, war was between cities. After Sargon, war was between systems. He replaced the heavy Sumerian phalanx with a faster, more flexible army of archers and axe-wielding soldiers. He marched south through Sumer, defeated the reigning king Lugal-Zagsi, and, in a gesture of calculated humiliation, paraded him in chains through the gate of the Temple of Enlil at Nippur. Then he turned north. He pushed into Syria, destroying the kingdom of Ebla, east into Elam, capturing its capital. His empire eventually stretched from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean, the first multi-ethnic state in recorded history. To administer it, he appointed governors across the provinces, stationed garrisons in conquered cities, and built a new capital, Akkad, in a location that has never been found. The city that ruled the world's first empire is still lost somewhere beneath the soil of Iraq. But to conquer is not to unite. Sargon's empire spoke two languages, Sumerian in the south and Akkadian in the north. Two peoples, two pantheons, two ways of seeing the world. The sword could force them to submit, but it could not make them feel like one. For that, Sargon used not his army, but his own daughter. In all of human literature, every poem, every novel, every screenplay, there is a first. A first person who put their thoughts into writing and signed them with their name. Her name was Enheduanna, Sargon's daughter. Sargon appointed her as High Priestess of the Great Temple of Ur, the most powerful religious position in southern Mesopotamia. But Enheduanna was far more than a political instrument. She was a poet of extraordinary force. She composed hymns and liturgies in two languages, Sumerian and Akkadian, the languages of her father's empire. In doing so, she helped forge a common cultural identity between conqueror and conquered. But her most remarkable works were personal. She wrote in the first person. She described her own emotions, her fear, her suffering, her devotion, her fury. As far as we know, no one had ever done this before. When a political rebellion forced her from her temple and into exile, she wrote directly to the goddess Inanna, "I, who once sat triumphant, was driven from my sanctuary. I was forced to flee among the swallows. My life is consumed. I approached the light, but the light scorched me. I approached the shade, but the clouds of a storm covered me." This is not a government record. This is not a hymn recited by committee. This is an individual consciousness pouring itself onto clay, the birth of the lyric voice, the beginning of literature as self-expression. Enheduanna's exile came to an end, the rebellion was crushed, and she returned to her temple. But her legacy was never primarily political. It was this. In the marshes of southern Iraq, before the pyramids of Giza were complete, a woman invented the idea that personal experience was worth recording, that an individual's inner life mattered enough to be written down and preserved. Every memoir, every diary, every poem that begins with I traces its lineage to her. But her father's empire lived not by poetry, but by force. And the next ruler proved that in full. Sargon's grandson, Naram-Sin, went further than his grandfather. He declared himself a living god, the first ruler in Mesopotamian history to claim divinity, and adopted the title King of the Four Corners of the World. Under his rule, the Akkadian Empire reached its zenith. But empires, as history would prove again and again, carry the seeds of their own collapse. The centralized system that functioned under strong rulers became brittle under weak ones. Environmental stress, likely severe drought, destabilized agriculture. From the Zagros Mountains to the east, a tribal people called the Gutians began raiding the plains. Within a generation of Naram-Sin's death, the empire that had conquered the known world ceased to exist. The Gutian occupation was a catastrophe. A mountain people unfamiliar with the complex irrigation systems of the plain, they let the canals deteriorate. Agriculture collapsed. Cities were abandoned. Only in the remote, swampy south did traditional Sumerian life continue more or less undisturbed. Around 2120 BC, a Sumerian king named Utu-Hegal of Uruk drove the Gutians out. Power then passed to the city of Ur, and a ruler named Ur-Nammu founded what historians call the Third Dynasty of Ur, the last great Sumerian kingdom. Ur-Nammu set about rebuilding. He restored the canals. He constructed the great ziggurat of Ur, a massive stepped temple to the moon god Nanna, whose ruins still rise above the Iraqi plains today. He compiled one of the earliest known law codes. and his administration developed a bureaucracy so detailed that we know more about the economy of Ur in 2050 BC than we know about most kingdoms of the medieval period. But the revival was fragile. Over-irrigation had poisoned the soil with salt. Crop yields were falling. From the west, the Amorites, nomadic tribes, were pushing into Mesopotamia, disrupting trade. From the east, the old enemy Elam was growing bolder. In 2004 BC, the Elamites sacked the city of Ur. The fall was so traumatic that the Sumerians wrote a poem about it, the Lament for Ur, in which the gods themselves are described as abandoning the city. Temples are looted. Mothers flee with children. The dead lie in the streets. With the fall of Ur, the Sumerian people ceased to exist as a political entity. The Amorite dynasties that followed, most importantly Babylon under Hammurabi, inherited their cities, their gods, their writing, their mathematics, their literature. The Sumerian language survived for centuries as a scholarly and religious tongue, much like Latin in medieval Europe, before it too fell silent. And then something extraordinary happened. The world forgot them entirely. Because the Sumerians built with clay and mud brick. The Egyptians left behind pyramids, impossible to miss. The Greeks left marble temples. But Sumerian cities, over centuries, crumbled into mounds indistinguishable from the desert itself. Their civilization literally dissolved into the landscape. You had to start digging to realize that an entire world lay beneath your feet. For nearly 4,000 years, no one knew the Sumerians had ever existed. It was not until the 1800s that European archaeologists, digging in the deserts of Iraq, began pulling clay tablets from the earth and realized they were reading a language older than everything, older than Greek, older than Hebrew, older than Sanskrit. A people erased from human memory was slowly reassembled from the fragments of their own records. Today, every time you check the clock, divide a circle, pour a beer, or sign your name, you are using a Sumerian inheritance. They built the architecture of daily life, and then disappeared so completely that we lived inside their inventions for millennia without knowing whose hands had made them. The Sumerians did not conquer the future with armies. They conquered it with ideas. And ideas, unlike empires, do not fall.